Accession number 19060, Reel 2.
Jim Murray, Reel 2.
Yes, the Australians were more casual than we were, in that the, with regard to the way they were dealt with, or the way they dealt with officers, they none of this jump to attention or this yes sir, no sir, and all that. Very casual that way, and generally just laid back. Well, we tended to be a little bit inexperienced and probably a little tense, probably just coming in to the line.
And they tended to be older than you were?
Oh, yes, they tended to be. The first battalion were mainly emigrants, mainly British emigrants who had gone there. And of course, they were earning about £15 a week, where we were earning £2 a week, or three guineas by then. Three guineas, they were earning 15.
Did they tell you anything about the enemy and...
Yes, and there's quite a few of them had been in combat and wounded once, some of them twice, been wounded twice and were still there. And some of them were, the ones that had been hurt, they weren't so laid back, they were the ones that were a bit stressed out.
So what was the next step?
Well, the battalion moved in and I think it was... The second time in the line, there was a hole appeared in the hillside opposite ours, and the Army intelligence said it was an emplacement for a gun that was going to withdraw into the hillside after it had fired a few rounds and that it needed to be got rid of. And so our corporal came to us telling us that he needed a volunteer to... carry a charge of 4 stone of gun cotton, 2 volunteers, and to go with A Company to deal with this job. And myself and another lad decided we would volunteer to do the job.
What was his name?
Ralph Grimwood. And he lives in Chesley Street now. And we went onto a hill, a similar hill outside the, behind the lines, to practice the procedure we would carry out in daylight. And till we had it off pat, we knew exactly where everything was and what we were going to do. But Ralph said to me, "What about if it's a night patrol?" I said, "How do you mean?" Because one of the instructions were that if there was any dead or wounded during the attack, press home the attack first, do what you've got to do, and pick up the dead and wounded coming back. And Ralph said, "What about if it's night time? How do we pick a man maybe gone into a coma or whatever? We'll not be able to..." I said, "Well, we'll play that one by ear. We'll wait and see." And sure enough, it was a night attack we had to do. And this was our first time in action. So this particular night, we blacked our faces, got armed up. Whole company was 40 or 50 people actually doing the attack, and about 40 on the riverside to cover our withdrawal. And as we went out through the minefield gap, the colour sergeant was there with a container of rum, navy rum, and he was just scooping a pint pot full of, and you could drink as much as you could out of that pot. So that really warmed the cockles of your heart up, sort of thing, and off we went. I was carrying the 3 stone end of the explosive, and Ralph was carrying the stone end, because there was like a charge on either end. Like, the idea was to put the small charge at the mouth of the cavern, to blow the mouth of the cavern, and with the longest fuse on the 3 stone charge, once the mouth of the cavern had been closed, it would then explode and cause more problems. So we crossed the river, everything was quiet. We crossed the paddy fields, crossed the river, and all the Commonwealth guns were firing on the hills we were going to attack and at either side. And as we were climbing the hill, they stopped firing on our hill to let us have access and kept firing on the hills at either side. And we were supposed to be in the back part of the patrol because it was like a sort of arrowhead formation. We were supposed to be protected by the troops on either side. But with us having a heavy load climbing the hill, we tended to work harder than what the troops were. So we ended up at the point of the patrol. And at that time, a light came on. I think it was off one of our tanks shone this light across, which was hopeless, really, because it left trenches and shell holes in shadow and exposed anything, including us, above it. And just as the light came on, this Chinese soldier came out of his bunker, and we're in a half-crouch position with this explosive, and Corporal Whitford was leading our particular group. He shot this Chinese bloke, but not before he threw a stick grenade at us. Just as he threw that stick grenade, Corporal Whitford shot him. And all we could do then was fall on the ground. And the stick grenade went over my shoulder and landed against Ralph and exploded. And then the battle commenced then, full-scale battle going. And they'd switched the light out, it was dark again. And I'm shouting, I'm going against the rules straight away. I'm shouting, stretcher bearer, stretcher bearer, knowing that they were within yards of me, these stretcher bearers. So I was going against the rules by crying for them now. And but anyhow, stretcher bearer was that, two stretcher bearers came straight away. And the corporal was pointing the gun, telling me to leave him and do as I was told. And I used a lot of bad language and carried on treating Rafi, who had joined the army with us, saying, don't leave us, don't leave us. I said, I'll not leave you, boy. And I got Michelle dressed and I bandaged his eye up, which is the only injury he was mentioned. I didn't know he had back and leg injuries as well. But I bandaged his eye, put him on a stretcher, and the blokes whipped him away. By then, I looked around and the firing had moved on, about 20 paces or so. And the corporal had left me and he'd gone. So I was left with the explosive. So my mind was working overtime then. So I, in the dark, no moon, I counted the paces direct from where I was till I come to the first soldier, who was a lad called Lance Corporal Crinian from West Hartlepool. And the first thing I asked him was his name. I said, what's your name? Right, come help me. And we counted the same number of steps and luckily came across the explosive again, picked the explosive up, and we knew we had to be off, veer off to the left a bit. And then somebody was shouting, it's over here, bloody big hole. So we pushed over and went into this hole, firing our Apaches, Sten guns then, firing our Sten guns. And when I saw the size of the hole, I'm using my own initiative here, like, I thought the stone of explosive wouldn't drop the mouth enough to do any good, to cause a better effect. So as I went in, I found a trapdoor in the floor of the thing. I decided to put the charge down there and just pull the main fuse, so the whole lot would go together. So this is what we did, and came back out, fired a flare, which we said that was the charge being laid. Whistles were blown to see we'd caught prisoners, and they got the word to withdraw, and we withdrew off the hill, hoping that they would, Chinese would, because we'd really took the hill. I don't know what strength they were in, but we'd actually took the hill by then, and so we withdraw hoping they would come back, and then they'd resume firing on once we got clear of it. So anyhow, we got back to our positions, and we were debriefed at daybreak, and we were told there was 15 men wounded and 3 men missing. And the first question Major Donoghue, who got killed later, he got his leg blown off later, Major Donoghue, Military Cross, he says to me, no, he didn't say to me, he said to the debriefing, how come this man, Grimwood, was injured and was back through the lines within the first shots of the attack being fired. And there was deadly silence, so I thought I would have to... So I got up and I said, well, that was me, sir. I says, stretcher bearers were there, and I decided to get them back. What did your NCO have to say about that? And I says, well, he tried to make me leave him, but I said I had to get rid of him first. And he says, well, you've gone against the instructions of the battle plan. He says, if it hadn't been for your initiative again to continue with what you did do, he says, it would have been a court martial waiting for you if you hadn't done that sort of thing, you know. And then I did tend to speak out a bit then. Like I says, yeah, but we did everything in daylight, good in daylight, but how can we do it? How can we guarantee to pick these people up at night? And I said, what about them three people that's missing? I said, maybe they're sitting in a shallow waiting to be picked up now. Of course, he blew his... Major Donoghue blew his top then. And I was sent back to me bunker, like, and it was all forgotten. And that was the end of that. But I saw that Ralphie Grimwood 30 years later, because he went home, he was out of the army. He lost his eye, had leg and back injuries. And he thought that was the end of the army as far as he was concerned. But he healed quickly, and he got out of hospital, and they took him back into the depot. And he was a one-eyed, crippled waiter waiting in the officer's mess, which, really, as he told me, gave him a hell of a... He felt really bad about it, you know. But anyhow, he went down to Civvy Street, and he took up his trade again, which was a bricklayer. Became foreman bricklayer, married the girl that he was writing to in Korea, and reared a family. And when he saw me 30 odd years later, he cuddled me and he swore down that I'd saved his life.
Did the gun cotton go off?
The gun cotton go off, and Paddy Manning, Sergeant Manning, I met him 2 years ago. He was the last, he was chivvying his platoon off the hill. And he was the last man on the hill. And he says it went off with it. He says, in fact, I think there could have been more explosive if it had caught, because the explosion was so great. And the intelligence said that it actually, not only that, but the shelling that had gone on as well, it changed the absolute contour of the hill, like, you know. So as far as we knew, it was successful.
When were you carrying... three and Ralph carrying one?
Well, that was the main charge. It couldn't be, as I say, it was on like a big pole. And the idea was, once we got to the site, was to jump on the pole and break it, get the small charge, put it to the front of the cave, get the big charge, put it to the rear of the cave, so the mouth would close, and that would create a bigger effect with the explosive. That was going to go off minutes later, sort of thing. And that was the way they could, that's the way it was set up for quickness when we got up there. But it was a bit uneven, to say the least.
So you were stronger than he was?
I was a stronger man than he was.
What was this trapdoor?
Well, this is what they did. They buried like rabbits, the Chinese. There was a trapdoor and there was bamboo steps leading down. I had no idea what depth. We tried a stone and we couldn't verify what depth it was, but I thought that would be the ideal place, what we call tamping, when the explosive is confined, it has a better effect, where if it hasn't, it would just have blown out the hole in the hole that was made, that would cause no problem, you know. So, but if it's got a barrier there, explosive works better that way, you know.
Would the Durham men know more about explosives and that type of thing than most troops?
Well, not really. I wouldn't think so. They were regarded as better diggers and miners because we're built for it, sort of thing, you know. And they were very good at sandbagging and things like that. And but shot firers were like special breeds in the pits. You were like trained. It was usually a deputy, a man who was like a charge hand sort of thing, that was taught shot firing and all that sort of thing. So he wouldn't. There wouldn't be many that would be experienced in explosives. And the experience we got was what we were taught in Berlin, you know, on that 3 months course.
Are Durham men of a particular build then?
Yes, I think we evolve. I think it's changing now, but because the mines are closing and the grub is better. But men tend to have longer bodies and short legs. And a lot of people say that's the way we've evolved over the years. Like my granddaddy, he started work at 7 down the mine, and he went carried to work on his dad's back. And his dad didn't get paid money them days, they just got tokens. And the tokens had to be spent at the shop, you know, the man who owned the mine sort of thing, the lord who owned the mine. And he went and he worked his way up over the years to become the overman at the colliery. But as I say, he died just after he retired from work. But yes, we tend to be a special build.
How did you feel about this ticking off you got from this officer?
This has affected me all my life, actually. Even to this day, I try to work it out. I felt good at the time when I knew I'd saved Ralph's life. Because I honestly didn't go back the same way as I came up. Because you're in a bit of a hurry getting off that hill before everything breaks loose. And I wouldn't have found him on because I didn't go back the way I came. So I honestly felt as though I'd saved his life. And as I say, I got it ticking off. And I thought I'd done a fair good job, considering it was my first time in action. But at the same time, I felt a little bit inadequate that I'd been more or less threatened with a court-martial.
But was this raid thought to be a success in your battalion?
It was. It was the best. I reckon it was the best one carried out in the whole year.
Which month did this occur in then?
Well, I can't. I think it must be. It was bad weather. The river was very, very cold. It must have been before Christmas in 52.
Maybe about November.
I reckon about that time.
And you say some Chinese soldiers were captured?
Oh, yes. What they'd done, they'd issued the snatch party with coches filled with lead, but hadn't armed them with any firearm. And they'd given men with firearms were to guard them. And the coche party had to literally jump in the trench and grab these fellas and hit them over the head with a coche and chuck them over the shoulders and carry them back. And as I say, because we tended to be a very average size of person, we picked the biggest fellas to do this job. And not having done it before, they did. They jumped in, very brave action, and as far as I'm concerned, jumping into a darkened trench and grabbing a body and not knowing what he was carrying and hitting him over the head till he is unconscious, and then carrying them all the way back. And because they hadn't done it before, they hit them too hard and killed them. But they didn't know that because they carried them all the way back to discover they were both dead.
Were the people who were missing, the 3 Durham men who were missing from the snatch party?
Yes, the 3 men that were missing were from A Company, and we moved position on the line 2 or 3 times in 3 months sort of thing. And one morning, the bodies of these 3 men were hung on the barbed wire. The cold weather had froze them solid, mind, and the rats had been eating them. And one of them was actually burnt. Well, we actually saw him. He had a phosphorus grenade on his flak jacket pocket, and a bullet must have caught it and ignited it, and we saw him like a human torch going over the hill. So those three bodies were actually with the dog tags still on, and that was the Chinese way of letting them know they knew which regiment was in which position, sort of thing. Although we had moved, they knew the Durhams were there, and they handed the dead over there.
How did the Durhams feel about their comrades being hung on the wire?
Well, it was a bit scary, really, but I mean, by then, the Durhams were quite a hardened fighting battalion by then. There's not a lot to upset them.
So that was your first time in action, then?
That was my first time in action, yeah. Well, I'm saying the first time that really got to me.
What do you remember after this?
Well, it was only a few months after this. It was still cold weather, and I was with A Company at the time again, and I was called to, I think it was B Company. There was a the minefield wire had broke on the enemy side, and the officer called me to help out as I was, because it was one complete section who did minefields, and I was the corporal of two section. And so he called me over to go with them to do this operation. And it was a moonless night again, and we questioned whether that was a good idea. Would it not be better going in the morning when it was foggy? Because there's usually a mist in the morning, and it was better working in mist as working totally blacked out. Anyhow, that was overruled, and we went out. We're literally following each other, touching each other, carrying our tools and following the wire around. Anyhow, we came to the break, and the wire had been, the explosion or whatever it was that had caused the wire to break, had thrown the cable inside the minefield. So we didn't know where the next pole was. So we shouldn't have gone on, but we did. We actually went with the officer leading, followed the wire, which we thought would have been better, if anything, to have gone left as opposed to right into the minefield. And the man with it was the batman, the officer's batman, who was carrying the radio, we found out later that what happened was he caught a tripwire, and it was a Yankee jumping jack. And the Yankee jumping jack shot out of its pot. It's the type of thing that shoots out of its pot, explodes at 6 foot in the air, and shatters down. It's shrapnel all over the place. So anyhow, he caught the tripwire. The next man was coming up as this Yankee jumping jack came out of its pot. It caught Ronnie Cut in the chest, and he was that high, just passing over my shoulder when it exploded. And the scream was terrible as he was thrown to the back of the patrol. And the pink flash, and I was deaf for a while. And when I came to, when the hearing came back, the officers over in this direction screaming on the ground, appeared to be on there because it was dark. And them that we could talk to told us what the injuries were, and I was the only one standing in the field. And all the rest were injured in some way or another. And all he said to me was, get out and get help. And I shouldn't have done. I should have got down, got my bayonet out and prodded my way out. And I didn't. I walked slightly. I didn't follow them in. I went off left like I was going to go in the first place. And there's a minefield gap within about 5 or 6 yards. So I followed the minefield gap, knowing it was coming back onto my company position. And then I suddenly stopped dead because I realised there'd be a standing patrol on the gap, covering the gap, man and one and four, or one and three, with a Bren gun and rifles. And they didn't know we were out. I'm saying they didn't know we were out. They probably heard that explosion and were alert, ready for trouble. And so I literally snuck up on them. And then as quick as I could, I went tearing in, speaking in broadest Geordie I could, hoping they wouldn't open fire. And luckily, the gun wasn't cocked, but the old Bren gun was being cocked as I was going over the parapet. And I dispersed them, except for one of them, to get a rescue party down there. Got a rescue party down there. I got the mine detector that was in the bunker that the dead man was supposed to keep in good nick. Brought it down. Batteries were empty. had to prod my way in, and we used just cotton wool out of the medical packs to try to mark the route in. And the officer, because I'd come from down the gap, the officer was the first person I came to. He then took the bayonet from me and started to prod his way to the wounded men. But in a short while, the Royal Engineers turned up, and they took over and got the remainder out. All of those went to hospital. The officer just with a bit of shock. Eddie Robinson with a swollen arm. But others had the heels blown off. Others had the calves of their legs blown off. And so there's four or five of us there, and they're all wounded except me. Only I was deaf. So they all went to hospital, and I went to me bunker. And me sergeant, thinking he was doing me a good job, give me three days off living in a hole in the ground, which didn't do me much good at all, just in me own bunker.
What would have been best for you?
Well, I think I should have had it. Looking back, I didn't at the time, mind. I thought that was the right thing. I was literally deaf, partially deaf, for 4 days before I come round. And then I was back to duty. And then the officer asked me to write a letter, rather than him, to his mum, as she'd had a mental breakdown. So I wrote to her, which wasn't my job really, but was the officer's job, but I wrote to her. And I got a letter back saying, calling me dear son. And the daughter said, she hoped I didn't mind her calling me son, but it would help her such a lot in the mental home, like to recover, you know. And this correspondence went on for the whole of Korea, the whole of Egypt, and the whole of my tour in Kenya. And then it stopped. I think she must have died. But she got out of, she recovered and went back home, right?
Where did she live?
In Corsham, Wiltshire.
So this must have been in the early part of 1953, then?
53, yeah.
In the winter?
It was either, as I say, it was the winter of 53. I can't remember the exact dates now.
And then what?
And after that, we had quite a quiet period then. And then there was the coronation, where we fired red, white, and blue flares. We got a bottle of beer and an ice cream, where the Americans had ice cream machines out there. They had ice cream every day. And we had one ice cream in the full year. And the ceasefire came the day after my birthday, my 20th birthday.
Did the coronation mean much to you?
Not a great deal out there. Not a great deal. We were just living. We were just trying to get through that year. We were thinking it could happen to us, you know. We might stop one. We just got to keep our heads down and do it, you know, look after ourselves. But there wasn't. It started to ease up then on our front, on our part of the front, anyhow. But at the same time, we know that we did back up the Black Watch when they were on the hook there.
What did that consist of?
Just mainly our machine gun platoons and things like that, covering trying to stop them at